The Colts in session. The Colts in session. Now, here come the judge. Here come the judge.
Here come the judge.
Peter B. Collins News and Comment. Monday, January 23rd. The Supremes got one right. It is a rare day when the moon and the stars align. And I can say that I agreed with a decision written by Justice Antonin Scalia. And perhaps it's because their own asses were being inspected, if you'll pardon my crude expression. The Supreme Court ruled unanimously today that law enforcement authorities need a warrant from a judge to affix a GPS device to a vehicle and monitor its every move. But they didn't say that a warrant was needed in all cases. This comes out of a case in Washington, D.C., of a guy accused of drug crimes, and they put one of these little remote control devices on his car and tracked him, where he went, and who he saw. And in the oral arguments, the Chief Justice himself, Mr. Roberts, asked, well, does this mean you could put one on my car? And the lawyer arguing for the government said, well, yes, Mr. Chief Justice. And so it's really good to see that, in general, the court respects the Fourth Amendment. They tossed out the life sentence of this drug dealer, who is the subject of a warrantless 28-day surveillance by GPS. Justice Sotomayor voted with the majority but wrote a separate opinion. And she said that she thinks Americans have more rights to privacy and data held by phone and internet companies than the Supreme Court has held in the past. So I still haven't really seen deep coverage on this. I'm relying on an article from Wired Magazine here, which calls it a convoluted decision. But based on the headlines, I am pleased that the court recognizes our fundamental Fourth Amendment rights. And now, if we can deal with wiretapping and email interception, maybe my quest to get, and forgive me if this offends you, but I have repeatedly said I want my goddamn Fourth Amendment back. And maybe this is a sign that that could happen over time. The police state has trapped Senator Rand Paul, the libertarian senator from Kentucky and son of presidential candidate Ron Paul. He was blocked from boarding a flight in Nashville. The body scanner detected something, and they moved him aside for a full body pat-down, and he declined. He missed his flight. They re-screened him and allowed him on the next flight. It's not clear from the report what exactly triggered the alarm, but I do agree with this statement from Ron Paul. The police state in this country is growing out of control. One of the ultimate embodiments of this is the TSA that gropes and grabs our children, our seniors, and our loved ones and neighbors with disabilities. The TSA does all of this while doing nothing to keep us safe. And Rand Paul dressed down John Pistole, the administrator of the TSA, in a hearing a few months back, regarding the harsh treatment of a six-year-old girl from Rand Paul's hometown of Bowling Green. He said, I guess this little girl would be part of the random pat-downs. This little girl from Bowling Green, Kentucky, one of my constituents. There's an Everly Brothers song about a girl from Bowling Green. They're still quite unhappy with you guys, as well as myself and a lot of other Americans who think you've gone overboard. You're missing the boat on terrorism because you're doing these invasive searches on six-year-old girls. Well, these are the kinds of experiences with Supreme Court justices thinking that they could be subject to the invasive, unconstitutional practices that our government uses. And when a United States senator gets treated like that at an airport, well, perhaps things can actually change. Last week, we released a podcast that included an interview with Truth Out investigative reporter Jason Leopold. And he has exposed that when you file a Freedom of Information Act with the FBI, they have an internal secret process where they can blackball all or part of your requests and then just say, oh, we couldn't find nothing that fit your request. Fareed Zakaria, The CNN anchor has co-authored a piece that's at Truth Out Today with Shakil Syed. And Syed joined a group of leaders in Southern California's Muslim community to try to find out if the government was conducting illegal surveillance of mosques, homes, and others simply because of people's religion. So, what did they do? They filed a FOIA request with the FBI. The FBI produced less than 100 pages in response. Unsatisfied, we filed a lawsuit and forced them to dig deeper into their databases. This time, the FBI produced over 800 pages. Was there some blackballing in that first request? Seems like it. But the 800 pages included massive redactions because supposedly the information contained was outside the scope of the request. Then the court ordered what's called an in-camera review, which means that the judge gets to review secret materials that are not displayed in open court. And the court concluded that the FBI's claim that very little of the information they had was responsive to our request was blatantly false. In a sealed order, the judge strongly criticized the government for having affirmatively misled the court. The government filed an emergency appeal, but the Ninth Circuit affirmed the district court's ruling and stressed that the government cannot, under any circumstances, withhold responsive information from the court because doing so would seriously compromise the court's function in overseeing FOIA actions. Why do we have to fight for these issues? Why don't government agencies follow the law? Well, we're making a little progress here with the Supreme Court decision and with the disclosures by Leopold and now Zakaria of the lack of honesty by the FBI. I was struggling for a euphemism there, but none presented itself. Over at the New York Times, they continue the struggle over whether to report the truth. The example in play when a presidential candidate says something that isn't true. Should the news reporter indicate that in the article covering that comment? For example, Mitt Romney last week said that President Obama does not have a jobs plan. And the Times, in the news article, or no, actually in a sidebar fact check, so they published the comment unchallenged, and then next to it they ran a column that said this is incorrect. And the public editor, Arthur Brisbane, I give him credit for at least airing these issues out, that is his job. He writes, the Times' fact check function is low-key compared with some others. So, for example, PolitiFact is a site that uses reporters from the Tampa Bay Times in Florida to investigate any questionable comments. And they go further than the New York Times. They have a truth-o-meter, a graphic that rates the claims from true to false. And in the case of a real whopper, they have the pants-on-fire designation. And Brisbane, in his column, says, I join others who worry that the Times needs to be very careful with this. Jill Abramson, the executive editor, said that if fact-checking were made a reflexive element of too many news stories, our readers would find the Times was being tendentious. Now, I'm sorry, Ms. Abramson, you're being an apologist for stenography, not journalism. Stenography is when you just catch verbatim what somebody said and offer no judgments. Journalism is when you honestly and objectively report what people said and offer honest and objective information or evidence to the extent that what was said isn't true. And finally, Brisbane says, I think the Times should broaden the fact-check sidebars to include issues that arise outside of the debate forum. Regular installments of fact-checking journalism identified as such would strengthen the paper's approach. Links from fact-check items back to the original articles online would help readers connect the dots. And this brings to mind Newt Gingrich's stunning victory in the South Carolina primary. and the media has a vested interest in establishing that it was their broadcast of debates that permitted Newt Gingrich to widen his lead. Well, first of all, he caught up with Mitt Romney and then widened his lead over him. It was a 20-point swing in the polls in less than a week. And while CNN broadcast a debate where John King asked Newt Gingrich about his ex-wife Marianne's comments about the open marriage and his sexual proclivities, when Gingrich fired back and blamed John King and CNN and the liberal media for even asking the question, CNN just laid down like my little lapdog Chloe sleeping on the floor over here and said, well, let's go to the next question. John King didn't have the spine or the cojones to fire back, well, Mr. Gingrich, aside from what your wife has said, you were run out of Washington by the Ethics Committee. You were fined $300,000, forced to resign as Speaker. You had a gruesome book deal that generated a lot of bad publicity when Rupert Murdoch gave you a $500,000 advance for your book. And we're supposed to forget about all that and your character-free personal life. And then values voters turn around and say, oh, yeah, Newt's the only one who can beat Obama. Who cares about values? And what is underplayed in all this is that it's the super PAC millions of dollars of negative TV ads on the air in sleepy South Carolina that really moved the needle for Gingrich. Gingrich got $5 million from a guy named Adelson, the millionaire or billionaire casino mogul from Nevada. Spent a lot of it in South Carolina attacking Mitt Romney. Rick Perry was attacking Mitt Romney. Rick Santorum was attacking Mitt Romney. I think even Ron Paul was in there with some TV ads attacking Mitt Romney. And their spending was outstripped by the super PACs. That's the real reason Newt Gingrich won South Carolina, in my humble opinion, I-M-H-O. In other news, the United States has been accused by the United Nations of flouting the law at Guantanamo. In a statement from Human Rights Chief Navi Pillay, quote, it is 10 years since the U.S. government opened the prison at Guantanamo, and now 3 years since 22 January 09 when the president ordered its closure within 12 months. Yet the facility continues to exist, and individuals remain arbitrarily detained indefinitely in clear breach of international law. He went on to say, while fully recognizing the right and duty of states to protect their people and territory from terrorist acts, I remind all branches of the U.S. government of their obligation under international human rights law to ensure that individuals deprived of their liberty can have the lawfulness of their detention reviewed before a court. Here's the recap. If there were a scoreboard at Guantanamo, it would show there are about 170 or so inmates still there. And about 130 of those are men who have been cleared for release but cannot leave because we won't let them and because we say we have no place to send them, including as many as 60 Yemen nationals. Yes, they're from the nation of Yemen. And they've been cleared for release. They cannot be tried because there isn't enough evidence that they had any involvement in terrorism. Many of these are the poor folks who were picked up for bounty payments back in 2002. And President Obama, the constitutional law scholar, knows that holding people indefinitely without charge or trial, especially those who have already been cleared through our own process, is inhumane, un-American, and, as the United Nations points out, a violation of our international treaty obligations. Speaking of Yemen, I want to renew my warning. The United States has given a visa to strongman Ali Abdullah Saleh in order to get him out of Yemen. And I worry that we will pay a price that we cannot predict for allowing him to come to the United States. And I remind you of what happened when Jimmy Carter allowed the Shah of Iran to come to the United States. First, we sent him to Panama saying, well, don't come too close. And then he claimed he needed medical treatment, and we let him into New York. And that was one of the moves that fueled the Ayatollah-driven Iranian revolution in the mid-70s. And this guy has a 33-year history of bloodshed, of repressing his people. And he's been granted immunity by the puppet government there. He and all of his cronies given immunity. And it's this desperate effort to get him, in response to the U.S. invitation and to prodding from the Arab League, to leave the country and turn over power. And he's promised to do it many times and always changes his mind. It was 2 weeks ago we offered him asylum, or at least a temporary visa to the United States. He said yes. I guess he's waiting for a private jet and luxury accommodations. Not quite sure. And speaking of Iran and its former Shah and the revolution, two Iranian lawmakers today stepped up threats that their country would shutter the strategic Strait of Hormuz in retaliation for oil sanctions on Tehran. And this is a very fluid situation, and that's not a pun on oil. Sorry about that. But last week it appeared that the U.S. was ratcheting down a little bit, and that Israel announced that it's not planning to attack Iran right now. But we're putting a lot of indirect pressure affecting Iranian oil sales. And the threat is if those sanctions continue, Iran will cut off the transit route through the Strait of Hormuz. And we've announced that if they do that, that's crossing a red line. I remain very concerned about the games that we're playing with Iran. And again, we know they do not have a nuclear weapon now. I think they want one. I think they want the bluffing power of pretending to have the capability or have developed it. But my fear is, in this highly charged election year, one false move and baby, the shock and awe will start. A report from the Charlotte Observer regarding rendition of so-called terror suspects. And this is not actually news to me that Aero Contractors Limited operates from the Johnston County Airport there. I first learned about it in a book called Torture Taxi by two young reporters from here in the Bay Area who worked with amateur plane spotters, people who like to sit at airports and keep records of who flies in and who flies out. And they were able to use the plane spotter data, to track one particular plane that was widely used as a torture taxi, picking up suspects who were kidnapped and delivering them to third nations where we knew they would be tortured. And I'm pleased to see this reporting, but the Obama administration will not let this action go anywhere. Whether they file a lawsuit, Deborah M. Weissman, who is a law professor, and members of a group called NC Stop Torture Now, have given copies to the Attorney General and the governor of their state. They're calling for an investigation and legal action. The problem is we've been down this path. The case was Jeppesen Aviation. And the plaintiff was Binyam Mohammed, a man who could prove with public information that he was picked up illegally. He was flown on one of these jets to a location where he was tortured. Binyam Mohammed, free now from Guantanamo. A British resident or citizen, I'm not sure which, but he tried to file charges in court here in California, and the government blocked them with a state secrets assertion. He has brought suit in Britain, and our government told the British that if they allowed justice to be served there, that it would adversely affect their relations with the United States. So the Obama team plays hardball on covering up things that we already know, that are not secret, but claim that they're too secret to allow a court to even hear a case based on the policies involved. It's very frustrating, and we need a break in those cases and in that line of attack. And I guess as long as Obama is president, we're not going to see it. And finally today, I want to comment on an op-ed published in Sunday's New York Times under the byline of Peter W. Singer. He's the director of the 21st Century Defense Initiative at the Brookings Institution, and he has a new book called Wired for War, The Robotic Revolution and Conflict in the 21st Century. And Singer, who discloses early in his article that he supports the use of unmanned aerial drones, nonetheless does a decent job of airing out some of the issues that should have been debated by our Congress and should have been voted on before we allowed the CIA's drone program to expand to the level it is today. And Singer talks about the benefits of using unmanned aerial drones, doesn't put American soldiers or flyers at risk, and, you know, militarily, I can understand the benefits that some people see. And he writes, I do not condemn these strikes. I support most of them. What troubles me, though, is how a new technology is short-circuiting the decision-making process for what used to be the most important choice a democracy could make. Something that would have been previously viewed as a war is simply not being treated like a war. And he talks about the use of drone strikes over Libya, 146 American drone strikes minimum. Congress didn't approve them. They occurred during and outside the 60-day deadline for the president under the War Powers Resolution to seek congressional authority. And the president just sidestepped that entirely. Oh, he made a few noises, sent a letter to Congress, but it's not the same as honoring the War Powers Resolution. Now, what's really missing from Singer's article here is a clear statement that many people on the receiving end of drone strikes or who live in the territories that we target regard us as terrorists. He also doesn't directly comment on the fact that when we fly a drone over Pakistan into the Waziristan tribal lands, we're not aware of any assets that the U.S. has on the ground there. So we're relying on aerial surveillance and information that comes from the Pakistanis, a very unreliable ally despite the billions we've paid them and the pretense that they are our partners in the so-called war on terror. And I can't forget, 2 years ago in the fall, Hillary Clinton was doing a kind of town hall meeting at a university in Pakistan, and a courageous woman in her 20s stood up and challenged Secretary of State Clinton, saying that these drone strikes amount to summary execution. And how different is this from terrorism? Well, back to Singer's article, he does make a couple of cogent arguments that I agree with. He writes, without any actual political debate, we've set an enormous precedent, blurring the civilian and military roles in war and circumventing the Constitution's mandate for authorizing it. Freeing the executive branch to act as it chooses may be appealing to some now, but many future scenarios will be less clear-cut. And each political party will very likely have a different view depending on who's in the White House. Unmanned operations are not costless, as they are too often described in the news media. Even worthy actions can sometimes have unintended consequences. Faisal Shahzad, the would-be Times Square bomber, was drawn into terrorism by the very predator strikes in Pakistan meant to stop terrorism. Finally, he writes, similarly, CIA drone strikes outside of declared war zones are setting a troubling precedent that we might not want to see followed by the close to 50 other nations that now possess the same unmanned technology. And what do we do when a Chinese or an Iranian or a Russian drone even conducts just a surveillance flight over U.S. territory or the so-called American homeland? How are we going to feel about that? Will we accuse the interloper of violating international conventions like we do? Well, that remains to be seen. We'll see how it all plays out. Thanks for listening today. Visit my website, peterbcollins.com. We've got fresh, in-depth interviews a couple of times a week.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling.